From Geico Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. Tonight's top worry: if something happens to your apartment and you need to, like, stay in a hotel and pay for it, that would be crazy, right? Art Palpitations has more.
That would be crazy, Tammy, but you got surprisingly affordable renter's insurance through Geico, so it could be covered, giving you peace of mind.
Aww, I love a story that ends well.
Next up, love stories. Are they all they're cracked up to be?
It feels good to worry less. It feels good to Geico.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, John Bishop talks to me about his life being turned into a heartfelt comedy drama starring Will Arnett in Is This Thing On? We, of course, talk Oscars in a week where Jesse did and Paul didn't. Plus, Chris Wasser reviews all the week's new cinema releases, including H is for Hawk. You can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcast, and of course it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well in a week where it appeared the world was going to hell and then came back from the brink, and in a week where the weather could only be described as mouldy. I do hope you're doing well, and in a week like this, thank God for movies and the escape they provide. And of course, the big movie story of the week was the Oscars. Hammett got a lot of nominations, none for Paul, but loads for other things as well. And of course, Element Pictures and Jesse Buckley and all that stuff. So I'm delighted now to be joined by the powerhouse behind the Dublin International Film Festival, Grainne Humphreys, to cast her cold eye over this week's nominations. Grainne, hello.
Hiya, how are you? Thanks very much. It's lovely to talk to you.
You too, you too. So listen, you know, the big story is Paul Mescal didn't get one. Jesse did. Were you surprised?
I was. I mean, I think, you know, you go back when you're looking at this and you're kind of reading, I suppose, whatever, the tea leaves or all the reviews or the kind of, you know, pollsters. Mm. And they all thought that it was possible for Sinners to break, I suppose, the 14 nominations that has kind of been the standard, you know, for Titanic, La La Land and All About Eve. But actually it went to 16. And yeah. I don't know, but when you were watching it, were you just going, and there's another one for Sinners, and there's another one for Sinners? And actually, the person who knocked out Paul is Delroy Lindo for Sinners, right? So in a way, it's like this wave of support that was going for Sinners, and Paul just didn't happen to get in there. Whereas, as I said, I thought Delroy was fantastic. Do you know? I thought I loved his performance. I'm a big fan of Sinners. But that, I think, was just a very, you know, unlucky bounce. Do you know what I mean? In that they were there. I also don't think that the two lads from one battle after another are going to do anything. I think they're going to cancel each other out. Do you know what I mean? So having the two of them in there, you know, effectively robbed, as I said, robbed Paul of a slot.
So in another year, he would have got one in essence if Sinners wasn't romping home.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But let's focus on the positive.
Absolutely.
Again, you know, we have a wonderful Irish short film in Retirement Plan in there. Richie Bannon is back for visual effects.
For Elephant. Avatar.
For Avatar, Fire and Ash. And we have, you know, now perennials. I mean, I presume they, you know, Andrew and Ed just have, you know, literally an Oscar black tie rig out, set up. Do you know what I mean? They send to the dry cleaners and know they're going to be using it.
We're talking about Element Pictures for the uninitiated.
Well, Element Pictures are a production company who has been behind so many wonderful kind of Oscar, you know, nominated Oscar winning films. They have a long-standing relationship with Yorgos Lanthimos. They've worked for many, many years with Lenny Abramson. They are also the people who run the Lighthouse Cinema.
Yes.
So they give a wonderful contribution, I suppose, to the kind of Irish film scene. But it's also lovely to see them not just as locals, but as, like, you know, global leaders who return year on year to one of the biggest events of the year.
Yeah, and this is all for Begonia, which, you know, it divided people, I think it's fair to say, but, you know, that's often the case with Oscar noms.
It is. And I think, you know, one of the things I would say about Begonia is that, you know, I know that Jessie in her Golden Globe speech talked about the diversity behind Hamlet, you know, that the director was Chinese, herself and Paul were Irish. There was a, you know, a production team from around the world. But I mean, in the same way, Ed and Andrew were Irish, Yorgos Lanthimos is Greek, and Emily Stone, or Emma Stone, is American. Mm. You know, there's a diversity about Begonia. I mean, actually, if we're going to talk about people who missed out, I thought Jesse Plemons missed out on a recognition. I thought he was fantastic. I thought that was a double hander in so many ways, you know. And I think sometimes you look at these lists and, you know, we've been talking about them for a couple of months now, and you do start picking out the gaps. But, you know, to make it into, what was that, 5-6 Irish representatives, that is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and Maggie O'Farrell as well.
Maggie O'Farrell there as well. I mean, it's kind of something special.
It absolutely is. And the boom time continues. Listen, away from the Irish, which I hate to do, but I was heartened, and this is a hard thing to say, the fact that Wicked wasn't given a nomination and that F1 was. Because I thought F1 is a great old-fashioned kind of, you know, boy, girl, fast cars kind of stuff. That reminded me of watching movies as a kid. Discuss Grainne Humphreys.
No, absolutely. I saw it with my mum in Screen 3 in the lighthouse, and she just kept turning around and doing a thumbs up. You know, she had such a good time. You know, and I think the other thing is that people said that they thought that F1 was going to get in for places like editing. Mm. And it did, you know, because it is. You know, there's a lot of big, shiny editing going on in that particular film. But I think the other thing that's interesting is the genre piece. I don't know if you noticed that, you know, I mean, you had Frankenstein in there, you had Sinners in there, you know, you have Weapons being recognised. You know, these are all horror films, genre films, sitting in, you know, what previously used to be a best film category that was very kind of biopic and important subjects kind of, you know, kind of standard operating procedure. And now it looks like they're kind of letting the more genre films in. It's really exciting.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, tea leaves things, if you had to at this remove think who would win Best Picture, what do you think it's going to be?
I'm not a fan of one bore after another. So I'm going to say I want to see a tie between Hamlet and Sinners.
Okay.
I want to see what that looks like.
Yeah. And at this remove, do you think Hamlet's going to pip Sinners to the post for best film?
I don't know. What I did? I did go back into the annals of history and took out the old charts. Titanic won 11 out of 14. Mm. La La Land won 6. And All About Eve won 6. Both of them were out of 14. And Sinners is going in with 16.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So it is either a night where it takes everything and everybody just starts, you know, going to the bar, or it's a fascinating kind of chess move where you don't know, you know, who's going to start kind of like locking up the kind of, you know, the awards. The technical ones will probably go, as I said, to, like you said, like F1, you know, Avatar, in those kind of directions. And then it'll be interesting to see, you know, K-pop Demon Hunters, you know, will Diane Warren finally, after, you know, 16 nominations, make her way to the podium, you know?
And then Best Actor, do you think Leonardo has it, or is it Marty Supreme?
I think Leonardo had his Oscar already. Yeah. And I think it could be Michael Jordan or Ethan Hawke.
Yeah. And you don't think it's going to be Chalamet?
I'm hoping it's not going to be Chalamet, so I'm refusing to say it publicly. I also think, and I'm going to say this out loud, I think he's young enough or old enough to have another shot.
Yeah.
But I do think what's really interesting is the international element. As ever, you know, 25% of the Oscars kind of voting members now live outside the US.
Yeah.
And I think you can see it. I mean, the fact that Wagner Moura is in there for The Secret Agent, you know, there's a lot. Stellan Skarsgård is in there.
Yeah, Sentimental Values, done, you know, very well. And tell me this, the final prediction. Is it a slam dunk for Jessie Buckley?
Yes.
Yes. Excellent. And tell me this. DIFF, Dublin International Film Festival, if I'm not mistaken, is launching its programme next week.
It is. Tuesday.
Fantastic.
Tuesday, we will reveal all.
And we've already got wind of Paul Rudd coming, though, so it's shaping up nicely.
It's shaping up nicely. It's a, I have to say, it's a really great year. We were delighted that we kind of like felt that we wanted to just go out a little bit early with our closing night film. Paul Rudd and Nick Jonas in the Board Gosh on the 1st of March. But there's lots of yes. really
well,
fascinating
you will be on to
Tuesday.
Talk. You will be on to talk about that, no doubt. Grainne Humphreys from Dublin International Film Festival has been deep in the annals, out with her maps and medals, giving us the hard numbers on this week's Oscar nominations. Grainne, thanks a million.
Thanks a million. Take care.
Grainne Humphreys there talking about the Oscars. So let's see what happens. As regular listeners to this show know, I love the Oscars. And I love the Oscars because they get people watching movies in cinemas or films in the cinema. So I'm all about it. Now, we did things backwards this week. We usually start with TV, but we had to talk about the Oscars. But let's talk about TV. And this week I was watching this.
This morning, Lumpkin County Sheriff's Office got a report, an anonymous call about a body being found in the National Forest in Dahlonega. Some deputies came out, and they did find a body. Female, 30s, Caucasian. She hasn't been formally identified, and once she has, and we notify the next kid, then we'll go ahead and release that name. But right now, we can't give you any more than that. That's all we got. Thank you very
Come
much
on,
for being
Detective.
Here. No, I need you.
Why the large police presence if it's not a murder?
Can you tell us how many sheriffs?
No cause of death's been determined at this time. Again, when we have something, we'll share it with y'all. Now, look, we have a job to do. You need to respect that. We're going to go ahead and respect that you have a job to do as well. I need you to move back to that other perimeter. Thank you. That's all we have.
Is there a suspect?
What are you telling us about the suspect?
Detective Harper, is it true you knew her?
Yes, John Bernthal there, opposite Tessa Thompson, two great actors who've both been on this show and who star in a great Netflix series called His and Hers, which at the last time of checking was number one on Netflix. This is a really good crime drama thriller. We have a dead body, as you can glean there, that shows up in this town, Dahlonega, which is just outside Atlanta in a rural part of America. And John Bernthal is charged with investigating it. Tessa Thompson is a reporter for a local news channel. She was the anchor, but she had some trauma. She disappeared for a year, and now she's back. And she's back to the town that she grew up in. And she's looking to investigate this case from a media point of view. But there are so many other twists and turns in this. There are a group of girls who were friends in school, along with Tessa Thompson. There was Tessa Thompson's mother, who appears to have Alzheimer's. There is John Bernthal's sister, who he's living with, and he's very close to her daughter. I can't say too much about this because it is spoiler-ridden. And we were doing it with Pat Kenny on Box this week, and I sent him some notes, and he said, you're giving away too much here. So I want to be really careful. But it is a great thriller. It is a great whodunit. Some people are suggesting it stretches credulity. You could say that, but I think it's pretty entertaining for January. Every episode leaves you wanting more and guessing. A lot of stuff is revealed. It's a real curate's egg. So I think it's great. What I love about it particularly is John Bernthal is a brilliant actor. He does that all-American, gee shucks, the world is on my shoulders thing. He's a brilliant actor. So is Tessa Thompson. They are both on fire in this. So I really enjoyed His and Hers. A great January viewing. It's a murder mystery. It's a great one. Little daft at times, but it'll hold you. I don't think you're going to be disappointed with it. I really don't. And I quickly also want to mention that the Assembly Ireland started on Virgin Media One this week. That is a show that's been on in Australia and the UK, where neurodiverse and autistic people interview celebrities and well-known people. And it's a great idea. And I remember watching the Danny Dyer one on BBC, and it's terrific. This started with Micheál Martin on Virgin Media on Tuesday night, I think it was. He was very good. You know, Micheál Martin is a politician, even though he spoke honestly. There is still a reputation to uphold, and I'm not sure if he was the best choice. As the first guest, I know Ryan Tuberty and Joanne McNally are upcoming. That said, it's a great idea. It's a great piece of TV. And I salute Virgin Media taking it on here and doing it, because it's very important that autistic and neurodiverse people see themselves, if that's not too talking down to people. But I think representation in that area is very important. I know that sounds a bit earnest, but it's also great TV. And the premise is that no questions are off limits. And I'm sure things are edited a bit, but the questions are, you know, they're fairly upfront sometimes. So it's a great piece of TV, and hats off to Virgin Media for getting the rights and doing it in Ireland. And I look forward to future episodes. Now, what I also look forward to is John Bishop, and he's with us after the break. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now take a listen to this.
I've been doing stand-up. Oh, I don't know how that is. That's a crazy handle. What, is she famous?
No. Dude, I've been doing stand-up comedy on stage downtown.
Okay.
What?
Is it like a hobby?
Well, I'm not about to quit my job and go on tour.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I love it, man. It's great. It's actually pretty amazing, and it's terrifying, but I love every aspect of it, and it's something I look forward to. It.
Fuck.
What?
I know it.
Knew what?
Just like, you've always been the funniest guy in the room forever, right? Ever since college, and now that you're actually fucking pursuing it.
I'm not pursuing.
You're going to kill it. It's inevitable.
Yes, Bradley Cooper opposite Will Arnett. Two great actors. And indeed, in the case of Bradley Cooper, great directors. This is from a new comedy that's in cinemas from next week called Is This Thing On? Alex Novak is getting divorced from Tessa Novak, and he finds himself at a crossroad. He's very sad about this. Their marriage is falling apart. He has two children. He's living just outside New York, suburban New York, and he rambles into a comedy club one night, almost by chance, does an act on stage, and it turns out he's pretty good at it. Bradley Cooper plays his artsy friend who's funny and wants to be a famous actor and is a bit all over the place and is married as well. Laura Dern plays Will Arnett's wife, and she plays it brilliantly, and they're kind of at each other and they've lost each other in their marriage, but there's still a lot of stuff there, you can tell. And this comedy, as you heard there in the clip, gives him light and might even help with his marriage in the future. Does this sound reminiscent of anyone? Yes, it's kind of John Bishop's life story, or a part of his life. The great Liverpudlian comedian, who's, I guess, the co-writer of the story in essence, even though this is Bradley Cooper's thing and Will Arnett plays him and it's transported to New York. But it's kind of his life story, because this happened to John Bishop. He went to a comedy club by chance, and he, one night, a couple of weeks later, his wife was in the audience. They have done a gorgeous version of this part of his life story in Is This Thing On? I loved this. It was funny. It was very sad at times about, you know, long-term marriages and getting through them and people changing in them. And Will Arnett, he's a very funny guy, but he does sincerity very well in this. It is beautiful and hilarious in equal measure. I absolutely loved it. I really did. We're talking about Is This Thing On?, which is in cinemas next week. It is based on the life in this particular part of John Bishop's career, who was in Dublin this week, and I got to go and have a chat with him. I met him a long time ago when I was a researcher on the Tom Dunn Show, so we make reference to that. So here's my chat with John Bishop about his life and times, and of course, Is This Thing On? Hello, John.
Hi, John. How are you?
Very well. Nice to see you. Tell me this. Does it strike you often that the randomness of life? So you stumble into this bar and do comedy, and then another random moment, your wife happens to be in the audience, and now your whole career flows out of that. There's a Hollywood movie starring Will Arnett. Are you struck by, you know, I could have not gone that night, or I could have had food poisoning? Or
I've never thought of the food poisoning angle, I've got to be honest. But yeah, listen, loads of things could have happened. Like that night, I ended up going into this comedy club. I had no interest in comedy, and it was an open mic night. So if you put your name down, you didn't have to pay to get in. So that's why I put my name down. Yeah. But to be honest with you, when you're talking about the randomness of it, I got called out second after a guy who was doing chicken impressions. Basically, that was his whole act. And I've said that before when people have told me about it, but it wasn't until we were doing some press for this and we were sat talking and I was sat with Will, who plays the character based on me, and sat with Bradley, who's the director, Bradley Cooper, And Will said something, because I was talking about the story, about the guy who went on first, and he literally just did chicken impressions. And then I got called out, and then Will said, what would you have done if he'd have been good? And I thought, oh yeah, because probably if I'd have sat there and this guy had been a really polished comedian, yeah, I might have gone, oh, I'm not up to this. But because I was just following a chicken, I thought that at least I can be as good as him.
Or if they've been great chicken impressions, exactly, could have been screwed. Tell me this, Will Arnett gets emotional and cries on stage at one point. And I heard you say in an interview before that the guy said after you came off, yeah, that was good, maybe don't cry as much the next time. Was that a joke, or did you actually shed tears on stage?
That was a joke.
Okay.
But when I did my last tour, and I was here actually, I recorded it here in Dublin, and for Sky, so it's on Sky, and I was talking about, because so many things have happened in the last 25 years, and I was celebrating 25 years of stand-up, and I thought I'll tell my side of this story, and it was amazing, because that did choke me. It choked me telling this story on stage. So I'm at the Tree Arena in front of 8,500 people, and I did get choked then. And you can see it on the Sky recording, because everything seems to have coalesced to this moment now that this film's out. We've captured that moment. And thinking back, most of the time you live life going that way, don't you? You don't look back. Yeah. And thinking back, thinking, God, this could have been so different, different.
Tell me this, as a lifelong Evertonian, me.
Oh, fuck.
No, I know.
So I did an interview the other day, and the guy sat there and said, I know you're an Evertonian. I said, well, where have you got that from? He said, oh, research. And I said, well, you've got to sack them.
Yeah, big time. No, I'm well aware. But as a lifelong Evertonian, was it really necessary for Will Arnett to wear not just a Liverpool jersey, but a Liverpool singlet in bed? Like,
the singlet bit's a personal choice, but
that wasn't your idea, was it?
No, that was his, because he's also a Liverpool fan. He's genuinely a Liverpool fan. In fact, we went to the match last week together.
The Burnley one?
Yeah. So it wasn't the best of games. But anyway, and that's his shirt. So he put that on as a little nod to me, really.
You don't actually bear Evertonians that much ill will, I don't think. I've heard you say over the years.
Not at all. No, my dad's twin brother's an Evertonian.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't see him, but...
The black sheep of the family. Tell me this, the Bradley Cooper character is great. He's hilarious, and let's get the bagels and all that. But I know, this is their story and they've used you. But I was thinking about it, I'm not sure if there was a person or people, but did you have a moment, you were keeping this to yourself that you were doing stand up, where their mates going, John, you're a funny guy, but I'm not sure about this? Or did you keep it secret for a while?
I didn't tell any of my mates. Yeah. And my mates, so Bradley Cooper plays the best friend of Will Arnett in this movie, which means all of my fat, bald mates are now saying Bradley Cooper's them in the film. And no, I kept it all from my mates. In fact, Melanie found out, my wife found out by coming to a gig, and we were split up, and she came not knowing I did stand-up comedy with people that she worked with. That's how she found out. And then the week after, my mates found out, because one of them had a baby, we were going out to wet the baby's heads, and one of the lads said, let's go to a comedy club. And it was the same club, the Frog and Bucket, so I went round and got on stage. That's how they found out.
Wow.
So I never told anyone.
Tell me this, you know that thing, how do you know someone's done a marathon? Because they tell you. I did the Dublin Marathon last year, and I remember in the aforementioned Tom Dunn show I told you about a long time ago on News Talk when I met you all those years ago, you ran 90 miles, right, from Dover to the centre of London.
Yeah.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but here you are playing the Three Arena, and I'm sure that's very hard to do, but running a marathon is the most exhausting thing I've personally ever done. To run, in essence, three of them, three and a half, was that the hardest thing you ever did? Because I saw the special and you looked shook.
What, the documentary when I did it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was part of this big charity challenge. So the first day is I rode from Paris to Calais, so riding a bike 186 miles,
yeah.
And then And then we rowed across the channel in a small boat.
And then you ran three miles.
And then we ran. And to be honest with you, the rowing was hard, because rowing across the channel in a small boat was not as popular then as it seems to be now. Loads of people are doing it. It's like paddle tennis. I think I've started the trend. But so by the time I started the running, I'd already done those things. And I found with the running, it was more, you probably find it with the marathon, it's more mental.
Yeah.
Just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's great to see you and continued success.
Thank you.
Cheers. John Bishop there talking to me about his life, providing the inspiration for the new movie, Is This Thing On? And that is in cinemas from next Friday, the 30th of January. A great watch. Great to see John Bishop. What a charming guy. Lovely dude. Very funny guy. And a Liverpool fan. Hey, we're all in it together. Up next, the week's new cinema releases, including H is for Hawk and the History of Sound. Yeah, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is The History of Sound, where our own Paul Mescal, the actor du jour, plays opposite Josh O'Connor in a kind of love story all centered around music in pre-war and post-war America. And we're also looking at an unusual movie called H is for Hawk, where we see Claire Foy bonding with a real-life hawk. To make sense of all this, I'm delighted to be joined by our regular reviewer, arts journalist and film critic and recent birthday boy, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello and happy birthday.
John, thanks a million. How are you?
Very well, very well. And this age really suits you, I have to say. I can, you know, I knew it as soon as you came on this call, you've matured.
I'll take that. I'll take that without actually revealing what that age is.
Exactly. Nor should you. Nor should you. So listen, one thing we can reveal is the history of sound. So this is Josh O'Connor and Paul Mescal, a gay love story set in the 1930s.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Man of the Minute, Josh O'Connor, and also another Man of the Minute, Paul Mescal, who has been picking up, you know, rave notices for his turn in Hamlet. But he's got two big films out ahead of award season. But this one actually premiered at Cannes last year. And because it is, you know, a queer romance and, you know, centered around these two guys, you know, and also a period romance centered around these two guys who, because of everything going on around them at the time, and because of, you know, the world that they live in, they aren't allowed to be together. There were all these comparisons at the time to Brokeback Mountain. And you might recall, you know, the film making headlines and Paul Mescal coming out and saying that, you know, these comparisons and the reviews were lazy and frustrating. And, you know, I do understand what he means there. But regardless of the differences between the two films, there are, you know, storytelling strands that connect these two different films, Brokeback Mountain and The History of Sound. I mean, in this film, we have two characters, David and Lionel, who come together in their formative years and have this very passionate romance. And also, you know, they're both connected by, you know, their love for music too. But they go off and lead separate lives afterwards. And we see other partners and other accomplishments. And then in the middle of the film, they come back together on an outdoor work assignment, which sees them, you know, sharing a tent, sleeping under the stars, spending a month or two in one another's company. So that was sort of... that's the sort of similarity to Brokeback Mountain that I'm getting. I do understand where Mescal's coming from. It's lazy to just say another gay romance. Oh, it's Brokeback Mountain. It's not that. It's the fact that the actual narrative follows a very familiar path.
Yeah, it sounds very close to, and I get what you're saying. You can understand why it sounds to him like an easy headline, because it's a gay love story and, you know, the love that back then dare not speak its name. But there are very similar narrative threads. But I suppose, and you give a good insight into it there, but they meet in a music conservatory in Boston or somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. So the central character here, you know, it is a bit of a two-hander, but Paul Mescal's Lionel Worthing is sort of the focus for most of the film. So we see this young kid on a farm in Kentucky, his father telling him that, you know, your voice and your understanding and your, you know, your musical ability is a gift from God. And the reason he says that is because Lionel, from a very young age, can almost see music. You know, colors form whenever he hears music, and he's able to kind of tell what note a frog's chirp is, a frog's croak is, a bird's chirp, you know, water splashing. Music is definitely in the future. So,
and I think it's called synesthesia, isn't it? Where you can hear where you can hear or you can taste and visualize sounds. Anyway, a pointless absolutely. Interruption to show my erudition. Go ahead.
No, you're showing off there, but it's absolutely right. Yeah, exhibited very well in the Pharrell Williams documentary last year, what this synesthesia, I think, is. But yeah, so music was always going to be in Lionel's future. So he enrolls in the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston in the spring of, or in the autumn of 1917. And there, you know, he's surrounded by other like-minded individuals, all very talented. And one of those individuals is David Weiss, played by Josh O'Connor, very good on the piano, thinks he knows every tune in the book, and that is until he meets Lionel, portrayed in adulthood by Paul Mescal, because the two of them kind of, you know, connect over this sing-song at the local pub, and David realizes, I don't know everything. You know, I haven't seen anything yet, and that maybe this chap's dad was right about it. Maybe his music ability is a gift from God, because they sing this song, Silver Dagger, and it's this classic American folk ballad with this soul-shattering message about love, and it just binds them straight away. So they become friends, they become lovers, and it's unfortunately they hit a bit of a roadblock. You know, that's an understatement. When World War One begins and you have, you know, America entering the war, David is drafted, Lionel isn't because of his poor eyesight, and Lionel, in a lovely moment in the film, just says to David, "Don't die." Because, you know, he wants to see him again. And let's just say, John, that they will see each other again.
Okay. And then this middle piece is them off kind of traveling America for a music project.
Yeah, I found the middle section just gorgeous, John. So there, you know, David does as he's told, and he comes back from, you know, the war alive. And he writes a letter to Lionel in Kentucky and says that he's got a job at a college in Maine, and he has been commissioned to do this academic expedition around rural Maine, where, you know, he's going to go around and talk to different communities and different families and collect and record traditional folk songs on wax cylinders. And he wants Lionel to join him. So Lionel says, you know, absolutely, leaves behind his mother on the farm, which he's not too happy about. And the two of them just travel across Maine on foot. You know, they camp out under the stars, they meet strangers, they record these phenomenal songs, they learn about these people and the songs, and they just learn more about each other. It's a part of their lives where their love affair is allowed to resume without anybody judging them, without anyone else around. And that, for me, is where the film, because everything after that, you know, you have the men returning to their lives and maybe potentially their families and careers and kind of, you know, dreaming about what might have been. That's what could have been between them. We see the life that they could have had together, and I think the film peaks there.
Okay, so is that the sense that the second act was the best part of the movie? So are you en route to saying the final act diminishes a bit?
A little bit, yeah. So okay. I found that to be just this gorgeous centerpiece, and I think Mescal O'Connor just spark off of one another there. You know, they do deliver the goods. And I found myself thinking afterwards, when they separate, where do you go after a story peaks too soon? And the answer, unfortunately, is nowhere interesting, because I think the problems emerge in this film, which is directed by Oliver Hermanis and written by a guy called Ben Shattuck, who is a writer and an artist and a painter. And he actually wrote these two short stories, one of them called The History of Sound, the other one called Origin Stories. And he's adapted those stories into a screenplay. And this is one of those times where I'm thinking to myself, you can tell that this is a short story and that it really doesn't have any business being a 130-minute drama. Okay. You know, there's something shorter here. So I think the other problems start to emerge when the filmmakers separate Mescal and O'Connor, because they're doing sterling work together here. I think The History of Sound, for all of its flaws, it's still, you know, a worthy addition to their CVs. I think Mescal is always good whenever he adds a musical twist to his, you know, his trademark melancholy. We saw that Carmen is not a good film, but he was very good at it and very good on the guitar, and his vocal work in it was lovely too. I think O'Connor is everywhere at the minute, but at the same time, the best British actor in the world at the minute. So I was very happy with their performances. I was very happy with them. You give them the spotlight, The History of Sound just soars. You keep them apart, and I just think the film loses its sheen and its colour, and it's a little bit out of tune in its final 40 minutes.
Ah, okay. Very interesting. As the song says, it's better when we're together. So no award nods for either of these two in this. So it's slightly lacking. It started very well, and the middle piece is beautiful. So what are you going to say stars-wise for The History of Sound, which is in cinemas from this Friday?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I saw that Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor a couple of years ago were going to be making this period romance around World War One and collecting folk songs together, I thought this has awards written all over it. And I did wonder why the film disappeared from the award season chatter. But now I know, because it's one of those cases where its tremendous performance is elevating, you know, material that is unfortunately a bit too ordinary. I think there's no getting around the fact that the film reaches its natural conclusion with about an hour still on the clock. Okay. There's too many false endings. I will say, though, it is nice to see Chris Cooper in there providing narration at first, and you will, and Chris Cooper, as far as I'm concerned, he could be reading a telephone directory and I will pay attention. He's narrating from an undisclosed setting that's revealed towards the end of the film. But unfortunately, by the time we get to him, things are a bit kind of awkward and a bit too drawn out and played out. So it's 3 stars. You know, I always say this, there's 5-star performances in this film, but as a film, it's 3 stars.
Okay, that sounds about fair. From what you've told me, I have not seen it, but here's a flavor of the history of sound.
This is a hobby in the summers, collecting tunes, ballads, songs. Reminds me of home. What else do you know? More than you, likely.
Pretty Sarah?
Of course.
Fair winter.
One went east, the other went west.
How about Silver Dagger?
No, I don't think so.
Oh.
Should I?
That was such a pretty song.
Well, come on, let's hear it. What key? Come on, what key?
I don't usually sing like this with
what?
With everyone talking.
Oh. Quiet, please!
I'm sorry, I didn't mean that.
Now you have to sing. You shy?
Don't sing love songs. You'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here right by my side. In her right hand, a silver dagger.
A clip there from The History of Sound, which Chris says has brilliant performances, but the last hour, or certainly 40 minutes, kind of runs out of steam. So that is 3 stars for The History of Sound. Now, Chris, something very different. It's Claire Foy getting over grief. And I'm not trying to be, you know, reductive or anything, but this is the truth of the matter. She's trying to get over grief by virtue of taking up hawking.
That's it in a nutshell. Yeah. And I don't know anything about birds, John. And I don't know, I've never read Helen MacDonald's memoir, H is for Hawk, before, which is, you know, about, you know, someone.
Sorry, I should say the movie is called H is for Hawk.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And I've never read the actual memoir, which details, you know, that kind of struggle to, you know, cope with grief, by essentially, you know, training and inviting a hawk into your home. So I think that the job for this film for me was to kind of, you know, to be accessible for newcomers who might not know much about nature or, you know, about goshawks at all. So you have Claire Foy taking the reins in this film as Helen, who is a research fellow at Cambridge. The job, the work, everything, the research, it seems to be going very well for her. And, you know, she's surrounded by people who she loves and who love her. She's got a cool best pal, played by our own Denise Coff. Christina is her name. She's got, you know, a famous photojournalist dad, Alistair MacDonald, played very well by Brendan Gleeson. Everything seems to be going well. And she's also coming towards the end of her research and wondering, what will I do next? All very exciting. Unfortunately, that's the moment in the story when bad things start happening. And her father quickly dies off screen, and she is just left absolutely devastated and has no choice but to hit the brakes on her life. When she starts to resume things, she's wondering, what will I do next? A rushed romance doesn't really go any well. There's talk of maybe a 3-year stint in, you know, a professional job or professional stint in Germany. That doesn't work out. She's quite, you know, she is depressed. She's quite directionless. In the end, she turns to this hawk handler pal for guidance, and she buys herself a Eurasian goshawk, the kind that she used to study from afar and admire with her dad, because her dad and herself connected over nature and birds and wildlife and all the rest of it. And that's, she decides, I'm going to bring a bird home and I'm going to train this bird to hunt. I'm going to bring this bird absolutely everywhere. And that's how I'm going to cope with my grief and kind of rediscover, you know, a joy for life. Now, the folks at Cambridge are saying to her, you're not allowed pets in the house. But as far as Helen is concerned, Mabel, which, you know, I think is a lovely name for essentially a grief support bird. Mabel is so much more than a pet, says Helen. And she starts to basically rearrange her entire life. You've got her mother, played by Lindsay Duncan, in the background saying, don't get lost. I probably don't need to tell you that Helen does get a little bit lost with the bird.
Yeah. And obviously, Brendan Gleeson plays her father, who we see throughout it, sometimes in flashback, I gather.
Yeah.
Tell me this. So the hawk is obviously, the gosh hawk that she gets is obviously one of the stars. From what I saw of it, that's a real bird. It's not CGI'd.
No, that's a real bird, yeah. Oh, yeah. CGI would absolutely ruin the film, I think. So I think, you know, it's an extraordinary and commendable performance from Claire Foy, who, to my eye at least, was completely at ease and authentic with that bird. Because it must be, you know, never work with children and animals, but, you know, I think you have a separate category for hawks who are just so unpredictable if you do not know how to be around.
Well, can I tell you, in another life, me and my erstwhile colleague Bobby Kerr were in a fancy hotel in the west of Ireland, and we did a radio package about hawking.
Okay.
And we both had the hawk hand, and it was fascinating and lovely, but it was kind of scary. And the idea of having to act with it seems bizarre. So I applaud your applauding of her, because it cannot have been easy.
Oh yeah, I mean, this idea that, you know, they know if you're anxious and afraid. So Claire Foy, before, you know, she even started to think about this, you know, performing this character, had to go off and learn how to do the things that Helen could do, because it's not as if Helen has just decided in this film, I'm going to, you know, invite a hawk into my home and I'm going to train one and I don't know anything about them. She did. But Claire Foy maybe didn't. So it's a great performance in that respect. And also with the human side of things, I would watch Claire Foy all day. I mean, she convinces as the Queen in The Crown. She convinces as the, you know, extraordinary, long-suffering wife of an astronaut and first man. She's always great. And I think Brendan Gleeson here too. I don't think I've ever applauded Brendan Gleeson for an accent before. Because sometimes they're not his, you know, his strong point. It's brilliant here. I think it's his accent as Alistair MacDonald is very good. I think it's ironic to call a man who dies in the first scene, in the first bit of a film, the beating heart of the film, but he returns in flashbacks.
Yeah.
And lovely. It's a small performance, but a lovely one. I think there is, though, a sense of strain throughout the film. It's quite respectable. It's quite warm-hearted, but there is this responsibility, I sense it anyway. It's directed by Philippa Lowthorpe, and also the co-writer is Emma Donoghue here. You can sense this responsibility to honor the nature side of the tale and then the real life drama. So it's kind of like, how do we hold both of those the way that the book did? Because the book at times can be a bit dense, I understand. I think the scrappiness of the narrative and that heavy responsibility, I think it kind of gets in the way of things. So in terms of the nature side of things, I actually wanted to know more about the training. I wanted to know more about the bird. There were some holes in the story there. And then in the human drama, I was a little bit confused about timelines, about the relationship between herself and her mother. There were some things that I had questions about afterwards. Nothing that can't be solved, I'm sure, by actually reading the book, but I wanted the film to answer those questions.
Sure. And I wonder sometimes, you know, because I enjoyed that memoir a couple of years ago, The Outrun, and then the movie that our own Saoirse Ronan starred in left me a little cold. And I just sometimes wonder, these memoirs of that particular kind that people get very invested in and pictures are painted in your mind with them, they can be hard to translate, particularly something like, and The Outrun was slightly differently. It was a grief of a different kind, I suppose. But, you know, these dense memoirs that, you know, have pages and pages to convey feeling. I don't know if it can be hard to convert them, I imagine.
Yeah, it's funny, like, people in our line of work are always talking about how fantasies and sci-fis and fantasies and sci-fis and horrors, sometimes, you know, the start on the page can often be unfilmable. I don't believe that's the case with any of those genres. I think when it comes to biographical stuff, when it comes to memoirs, that's the tricky thing. How do you take something that is, you know, a book that is as much about, you know, informing the reader about, you know, nature and, you know, the training of this beautiful creature, as it is about, you know, how to cope with the grief of a loved one. Like, how do you put that on the screen? Unfortunately, with a bit of difficulty, you know, based on what we're seeing here. But I did like this film all the same. It is, you know, it is a bit muddled, but it's very well intentioned, very well performed. One of those features, again, a little bit like The History of Sound this week, where you, something you can tell in the narrative isn't working, but you've got these astonishing performances just elevating it. So I think everyone involved here, Philippa Lothrop, Emma Donoghue, they're very lucky to have Claire Foy, very lucky to have Brendan Gleeson on a very good day. I like this. Go see it.
So are you edging towards 3 stars there?
I am edging towards 3. And I think that makes it sound as if it's not great. Not saying that at all. You know, this still is worth a watch. I just think maybe lower your expectations a little bit, especially if you loved the book.
Okay. H is for Hawk gets 3 stars. And before that, The History of Sound gets 3 stars. But in the week of Blue Monday, that isn't bad going, I would suggest to you. And certainly not bad going was the performance of Birthday Boy, arts journalist and film critic Chris Wasser. Chris, thanks a million.
Cheers, John.
Chris Wasser there reviewing H is for Hawk, which he gave 3 stars to, and also before that, The History of Sound, which he also gave 3 stars to. Do get in touch to let me know what you've been watching or enjoying or not enjoying. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. Last week I heard from Mark, who finally got around to watching Mayor of Easttown and thought it was terrific. Also heard from Seamus, who was telling me about Nikki Glaser roasting people. Lots of people were in touch about The Rip on Netflix, saying they enjoyed it very much. And also the interview we had with Ben Affleck, although some people were bemoaning the fact that he saw fit to do an Irish accent at me. I didn't mind. Such are the slings and arrows of outrageous movie interview fortunes. Anyway, do get in touch with anything. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead. I will talk to you all next week. I'll leave you with a little music from the movies. This is one of the greatest duets of all time. Dueling voices in the form of David Bowie and Queen. And why am I playing that? Because it used a brilliant effect in the movie Is This Thing On? So that's why I'm going to play that. Who's going to complain if I play Queen and David Bowie and Under Pressure? So I leave you with that and wish you a happy remainder.